I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera of Chicago. I'm eager to tell you about a work we're presenting for the very first time during the 2018-2019 season, Jules Massenet's glorious Cendrillon. Certain composers have always needed a champion to draw attention to their excellence and create an enduring audience for their works in the opera house. Massenet is a good example. This amazingly gifted Frenchman was probably his country's most commercially successful opera composer in the last quarter of the 19th century. He just had a knack for pleasing the public. But by the 1930s, outside France, the majority of his works had fallen by the wayside. Opera companies would still take on Manon, also Werther, but not much else. In the 1970s, we did have something of a Massenet revival, with certain pieces reassessed. Don Quixote, Thaïs, and the even lesser-known Esclarmonde, Le Roi de Lahore, and Thérèse. Nowadays, though, it's rare that we find a lesser-known Massenet work in a major theater. But one of those pieces was brought back into circulation 4 decades ago, and at this point has definitely entered the repertoire in a major way, with productions all over the world. It's great news for anyone who loves French opera that Cendrillon really does seem here to stay. Initially, it had its chief advocate in Frederica von Stade. She sang Cendrillon with many important companies throughout North America. In the next generation, Joyce DiDonato has done the same thing internationally. Together, those artists have made every gifted lyric mezzo understand what a desirable, hugely rewarding role Cendrillon can be. At Lyric Opera of Chicago, we're lucky to have another champion of Massenet, our music director, Sir Andrew Davis. He's brought back into our audience's life certain Massenet operas that we had done very infrequently. For example, when Sir Andrew conducted Thaïs at Lyric in 2003, we'd only produced it once before. That was back in 1959. That piece started Sir Andrew's love affair with the music of Massenet. He's also conducted Thaïs at Covent Garden, at the Edinburgh International Festival, and in Australia with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. Then in 2011, he took on Werther, after that opera had been absent at Lyric for more than 3 decades. In 2014, he conducted his first Cendrillon. It captivated him when he led it at the Grand Théâtre del Liceu in Barcelona. Then, at Lyric, he led the company's Don Quixote, another piece our audience hadn't heard in many years. Sir Andrew's passion for the beauty and elegance of Massenet's music and his consistent success in revealing its magic to our audience has created a huge sense of anticipation for the company's very first Cendrillon. What is it about this version of the Cinderella story that has made it the most popular of all the rediscovered Massenet operas? One important quality of the piece is its extraordinary heart, which emerges in the incredibly affecting characterization of Cendrillon herself. And she's surrounded by 4 other principal participants in the story who bring it to instant life and sustain our rapt attention throughout. Cendrillon's father, Pandolfe, her stepmother, Madame de l'Altière, le Prince Charmant, a.k.a. Prince Charming, and the character known in the opera simply as La Fée, the fairy, but whom, for all intents and purposes, we can refer to as the fairy godmother. The music through the entire piece is wonderfully varied, the text very much in the spirit of the opera's literary source, Charles Perrault's Cendrillon ou la petite pantoufle de verre, Cinderella, or the Little Glass Slipper. Perrault, a lifelong Parisian, was born in 1628 and died in 1703. He was a writer of beautiful prose and poetry. His gifts were recognized officially when he was invited to become a member of Paris's enormously prestigious literary academy, the Académie Française. Perrault came from a wealthy family and studied law, after which he embarked on a successful career as a government administrator who supervised the management of royal buildings. It wasn't until he reached his mid-60s that his writing brought him huge fame. The vehicle, amazingly enough, was the fairy tale. Perrault was actually a pioneer in that whole literary realm, the first truly great writer to create that sort of story. What he gave the world was a collection he entitled Histoire ou Contes du Temps Passé, Stories or Tales of the Past, subtitled Les Contes de la Mère Loi, Tales of Mother Goose. The whole world has always been grateful to Perrault for that collection, given that it included some of the most beloved stories ever written by anyone. Little Red Riding Hood, Puss in Boots, Sleeping Beauty, and of course, Cinderella. The book's popularity took off. It was translated into English as long ago as 1729. Cinderella, of course, is part of popular culture. The earliest version we know of the story goes back to ancient Greece, with a tale of Rhodopis, the courtesan who marries the king of Egypt. The basic elements of Cinderella have been adapted endlessly in literature, including a much darker version than Perrault's, written by the Brothers Grimm. Cinderella has been produced in all sorts of ways on stage, from British pantomimes to a wonderful full-length ballet with music by Prokofiev that has long been a staple of major companies internationally. IMDb.com gives no fewer than 200 listings for various versions of the story created for film and television, going back to a short subject made in 1898. There were the two Disney versions, animated in 1950 and live action 65 years later. Musical theater got into the act in 1957 with a new Cinderella by Rodgers and Hammerstein, no less, seen in black and white by an astoundingly large audience nationwide, 107 million viewers. It was revived again in new televised productions in 1965 and 1997. There have been films like The Slipper and the Rose and Ever After. Pretty Woman has its Cinderella-ish elements. And in 1960, there was even a Cinderfella, with Jerry Lewis in the title role and Anna Maria Alberghetti as Princess Charming. Everyone, everywhere, adores the story of Cinderella. Opera has been part of the evolution of this story, beginning in the mid-18th century with a Cendrillon by Jean-Louis Larnet, produced by the Opéra Comique in Paris. There have been innumerable other versions, including Rossini's La Cenerentola in 1816, also works of Isouard, Wolf Ferrari, and even one composed by one of the most illustrious singers of the 19th century, mezzo-soprano Pauline Viardot. In 2017, in California, following the European premiere, Opera San Jose gave the American premiere of a full-length Cinderella by a 12-year-old English girl, Alma Deutscher, one of the most amazing feats by a child prodigy in living memory. In preparing his operatic Cinderella, Jules Massenet was ideally matched with his librettist, Henri Quint. They'd first worked together on two Verismo style operas, La Navarrese in 1894 and Sappho in 1897. After Cendrillon, 2 years after that, there would be four more collaborations prior to Massenet's death in 1912. Massenet and Quint went beyond Perrault in some interesting ways. Most important was their expanding of the roles of the fairy godmother, Cinderella's father, and Prince Charming to give them real dimension and interest. Composer and librettist were also both very savvy theatrically and in their ideas of what audiences would most enjoy. It's the variety of the piece, the total integration of sung dialogue with arias, duets, ensembles, choruses, and dance music, and the sheer charm of the entire work that makes it such a captivating experience in the opera house. Massenet dedicated Cendrillon to the creator of the title role, Julie Giraudon. By all accounts, she was a totally adorable singer. We can't really judge her from her few records, but looking at photographs, she looks like she'd play the most enchanting Cinderella imaginable. She clearly enraptured both Massenet, who always lost his heart to his leading ladies, and Henri Quint, who later married her. She was actually a soprano, and it's true that a lyric soprano with a strong lower and middle register can easily sing Cendrillon. We do encounter lyric mezzos more often than sopranos in the role, but as long as the voice of the Cendrillon contrasts well with the voice of the mezzo singing the trouser role of the prince, And as long as those two voices create a fine blend, it doesn't matter whether Cendrillon is a mezzo or a soprano. The commission for Cendrillon came from the Opéra Comique and had originated with its director, Léon Carvalho. But the premiere kept getting postponed, leaving Massenet in despair. Carvalho died in late 1897, and once his successor was chosen, the path was soon clear for Cendrillon. The new director of the company was Albert Carré, who was to make very significant contributions to the propagation of new French operas during the next three decades. He made it his aim to produce an absolutely smashing premiere of Cendrillon, with an opulence that even the much grander scale Opéra de Paris would envy. In addition to the lovely Julie Girardon, the cast of the world premiere also included two truly remarkable artists, Blanche de Changéen, one of France's greatest dramatic contraltos, who had a real change of pace portraying Cendrillon's stepmother, and, as the heroine's father, one of the legends of French opera, bass baritone Lucien Fugere, who, during a very long career, became known as the consummate singing actor, with a special gift for comic parts. He and Madame de Changéen were hugely important figures in world premieres of major French works. For example, they would again play opposite each other in 1900, creating the roles of the heroine's mother and father in one of the first great operas of the 20th century, Charpentier's Louise. Cendrillon was Massenet's 14th published opera. It premiered at the Opéra Comique in 1899, late in the 57-year-old composer's career, and at the height of the Belle Époque. It was a triumphant success, and just 3 years after that first performance, it was introduced to American audiences in New Orleans. As for the story, it's different in many ways from the most familiar operatic version of Cinderella, Rossini's La Cenerentola. One attribute the Italian and the French heroine share is that each of them has a nickname. Cenerentola and Cendrillon both can be translated as Little Girl of the Cinders. In case you want to know their real names, Rossini's character is Angelina, and Massenet's is Lucette. As with the Rossini opera, in Massenet's, the heroine's father is an important character. Pandolf is sweet and gentle, unlike Cenerentola's father, the foolish Don Magnifico. Perhaps Pandolf is too meek for his own good. Certainly he seriously regrets his marriage to Cendrillon's stepmother, a character who doesn't appear in Rossini at all. Madame de la Altière is incorrigibly bossy and outrageously self-important, and her daughters, Cendrillon's stepsisters Noémie and Dorothée, are simply the silliest, giddiest girls in opera. The stepsisters, the stepmother, and the father go to the ball where Prince Charming is going to pick a wife. The moment they've left the house, who should show up but Cendrillon's fairy godmother? She makes it possible for the girl to go to the ball. She arranges everything, the coach, the coachman, and Cendrillon's ball attire, which includes glass slippers. In the second of the opera's four acts, we're at the palace, where it's pretty clear in the prince's monologue that he's a very melancholy young man. He truly longs to find love. At the ball, there's a ballet in which all the visiting princesses are presented to the prince. But when Cendrillon appears, the prince has eyes only for her. She won't tell him her name and simply says, "Vous êtes mon prince charmant." You are my prince charming, and I'll cherish the memory of this moment until I die. It's midnight. In the Perrault tale, the clock actually strikes 11 3/4. And of course, that's the signal for Cendrillon to rush away, leaving one of her glass slippers behind. Interestingly, in Perrault's story, Cendrillon and the sisters also go to the ball the next night, where the same thing happens. The prince is again enchanted by the unknown princess, who leaves the ball very suddenly. As with most of the other versions of this story, in every medium, Massenet and his librettist settled for just one night. In Act 3, Cendrillon gets home safely, immensely relieved that she's made it there before the arrival of her family. Now we have a major departure from Perrault. Cendrillon is devastated to have left the prince and decides to hide the misery from her father by running away. But she falls asleep, and her dream appears before us. She's in the fairy godmother's enchanted forest, and she's with the prince. In the production we're presenting at Lyric, rather than a forest, the set designer Barbara de Limbourg puts the scene in a very different but similarly mysterious realm, the dark rooftops of Paris, like the London chimney sweep scene in the movie Mary Poppins. The next morning, Cendrillon's concerned father tells her that she was dreaming about a forest and the ball and the prince. A royal herald arrives and proclaims that the prince wants to see every princess who attended the ball. He's promised to marry whoever it was who left behind the glass slipper. Miraculously, the fairy godmother appears and brings Cendrillon to the palace, where the prince sees her. Of course, the slipper fits her perfectly. We hear again, "Vous êtes mon prince charmant," and we have the happily ever after ending. The opera is a wonderful combination of styles, which was important to Massenet. He can be lushly, grandly romantic, but also intimate and sweet, but never cloying. Thanks to the indomitable Madame de la Altière, there's also a pomposity worthy of Perrault, who described the stepmother as the proudest and most haughty woman who ever was seen. As envisioned by Massenet and his librettist, Madame's scenes wouldn't be out of place in comic operettas by Offenbach. At one point in Act III, after coming home from the ball, she pooh-poohs the qualities of the unknown princess and sings a hilarious aria giving all the details of her own magnificent family pedigree. Madame actually gets a mild comeuppance in the final moments of the opera. At the palace, after Cendrillon successfully fits her foot into the glass slipper, Madame rushes forward to proclaim before one and all that the prince is going to marry her stepdaughter, whom she so dearly loves. Her own daughters, as well as everyone else, jeer at this obviously insincere change in her feelings. It's immediately thereafter that Pandolf steps forward to proclaim to all of us in the audience, "Ici tout finit bien," here everything is ending well. Massenet's ballet music recalls Baroque minuets, and in contrast, Massenet gives us the vigorous march of the princesses when they're presented to the prince at the ball. If you enjoy the sheer tenderness and the love music that we get in Massenet's Manon and Werther, you'll adore Cendrillon. From the heroine and her prince, you'll also hear big, broad, soaring climaxes that will probably remind you of the operas of Richard Strauss. Whether sung by lyric soprano or high mezzo-soprano, the role of Cendrillon needs not only a luminous upper register and the ability to float the voice in pianissimo, but also a particularly solid middle range. It's interesting to remember that the first Cendrillon, Mademoiselle Guillaudon, was also Mimi in the first French performances of La Bohème. The combination of Cendrillon's and the prince's voices, whenever they're singing together, is as magical as what you'd find when two women partner each other in Mozart, in bel canto repertoire, or in Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier. Their scenes are passionate and soulful, with moments of melancholy that truly touch the heart. With these two, we have some of the most sheerly beautiful duets to be found anywhere in opera. There's a recording on a major label where the role of the prince was assigned to a tenor. But when you hear a high mezzo instead, you realize that Massenet really did know exactly what he was doing. Perrault calls the heroine of his Cendrillon the best creature in the world. That's also the impression she gives in the opera. Here we have one of the sweetest, most unselfish, and most loving heroines, not just in French repertoire, but in any opera. The loneliness, the rejection, and the sadness all come through powerfully in her music. But it's clear how much hope she has and how much she believes in love and goodness. We see her capacity for love not just in her scenes with the prince, but when she's with her father. That relationship is one of the most appealing aspects of this opera. For his part, Prince Charming is much more interesting, more complex emotionally, than in Rossini's opera or, for that matter, in Perrault's tale. He's given a real emotional journey, basically moving from inexperienced and petulant boy to loving man. In the production we're doing at Lyric, in his first scene, he's dressed in his pajamas, trapped among the palace's courtiers and ministers. In a very quiet but exceedingly heartfelt monologue, he sings, "As soon as I see the woman my soul desires, I'll know, and I'll say I'm yours." When he sees Cendrillon for the first time, it's an incredibly heartwarming moment. The fairy godmother is very feisty. She's got chutzpah for days. Clearly, Massenet wanted shimmering sound for the character, especially in her upper octave. He assigned it to coloratura soprano, after all. It requires superhuman technique to sing. But when done well, it can give listeners shivers of pleasure. One of the major figures in French opera today, Laurent Pellin, is both director and costume designer of the production we're presenting at Lyric, which has previously been a huge success in many major houses, among them the Metropolitan Opera and the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. Pelly has mentioned on many occasions that, as a child, whenever he visited his grandmother, he read the Cendrillon story in a book of Perrault's fairy tales, a massive red and gold book from the early 20th century with illustrations by the incomparable Gustave Doré. It was a book that had long been cherished by families all over France. Pelly's production is, in a way, an homage to the book and to his joyful experiences reading it. The story is actually written out on the walls of the set for his production. Pelly has said that he feels challenged and excited by Cendrillon's range of musical colors and styles. There's a lightness of touch in his handling of the story that makes his vision of Cendrillon a special joy. The costumes are characterful and often over the top in a very witty way, especially the huge paniers for Madame de la Altière and the gowns for the visiting princesses at the ball, all extravagant and bright red, which makes the white of Cendrillon's simple but elegant ball gown stand out doubly. The movement for everyone on stage in this production is very, very precisely choreographed, which adds hugely to our pleasure. What a treat Cendrillon is going to be. Romantic, comical, warm-hearted, unforgettably beautiful vocally and musically. It's instantly accessible, truly family-friendly. I know the long-awaited Lyric premiere will be one of the great highlights of your opera-going this season. Thank you for listening. Lyric's commentaries are made possible through the generous support of the Patrick G. and Shirley Welsh Ryan Foundation in memory of their parents. The music that you have heard is generously furnished by Naxos Records and is available for purchase on iTunes.